Thank you. I am Chuck C., and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. What I'd like to do is have you all stand up and let me give you a hand. I want to thank you all for coming. You know, I never get over it. I feel real good when people come out, you know, because I've been around a long time. And every time I go out, and particularly in my own area, I think this time nobody will come, you know, because I've been covering the place for like a blanket for 23 years. And they're there. And it does something real good to me. And I thank you all for coming. I think it's real good when you come a couple of thousand miles to yak a little, somebody comes. You know, it's nice. I have already been paid several times for coming down here. It seems like I know you all of you. And I love some of you much better than I do me. Many of you in this crowd, I love better than I do me. And I'm most grateful for the opportunity to share this weekend with you. Again, I'd be ready to go home right now. Really. I'm full to the brim. The longer I'm around this fellowship, the more totally I am aware of the mutual need of one alcoholic for another. The mutual need of one alcoholic for another. You see, I need you much more than you do me. Because I am one and you are many. Alcoholics Anonymous was doing very well before I came. And I wasn't. And it'll be doing very well after I'm gone. So I'm grateful just to be a part of it. Again, it becomes increasingly clear to me that the only difference between me now and 24 years ago is the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the only difference. You see, tonight, but for the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous and the grace of God, I would be a tongue-chewing, babbling, idiot drunk writhing in the floor. Tonight, not 23 years ago, but tonight, but for the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because, you see, I cannot stay sober. And of myself, I can't keep from drinking. And so I'm most grateful, because I've had now a little over 8,400 days, one day at a time, without the necessity to take a drink of liquor or a sedating or tranquilizing pill of any kind. That's 8,000 days that I would not have had, but for the grace of God, through the miracle of this program, God. Now I'm quite sure that very few of us ever deliberately take ourselves out of this program. I don't think many of us do. I have known one couple in my 23 years who deliberately took themselves out of the program. This was a guy from Texas. Big, fine-looking, bald-headed guy with his good wife, Pat. 20-some years ago, we used to talk as a team. Kurt and I. He was sober for 5 years with his good wife, and they decided that they knew enough about this program and about themselves and about spiritual things that they could live normally without the program. And they deliberately took themselves out of the program, and they pretty nearly made it. They had us scared to death. Really, they did. Kurt had a parking lot in downtown Beverly Hills. And I saw him at least once a week. And I'd say to him, Kurt, how you doing? And he'd say, fine. And by George, he was. And a year went by, and two, and three, and four. And we were saying to ourselves off in the corner, is this the pair that's going to prove us wrong, you know? Are they going to do it? But the fifth year, they went to hell in a basket. And it's been a very sad situation. The first time I saw Kurt after this little experience, he came back to the Beverly Hills Stag meeting. You remember that one, boss? And he says, Chuck, if you think it's tough the first time, try it again. He says, this is like coming up to the back door of a mansion you once owned and asking for a handout. And Kurt's still trying to get back. And a few years ago, several, as a matter of fact, we had a chap by the name of Manuel Rios, God rest his soul. Manuel had cancer. And he knew it was terminal, but he never quit. He was in there pitching right up until the last dog died. And it fell my little chore to give his funeral. You know, out in our country, many, many of our people, for reasons of their own, want an AA funeral. Even those who have a church of their own, many of them want an AA funeral. And it falls my lot to give a lot of them. And so I wish to talk for Manuel at his request. And just before I went in, and incidentally, not only was the building full, but the yard was full and the street was full of people. That's what we thought of Manuel out there. And just as I was going in, they handed me a little slip of paper. It was a clipping from a newspaper. And it says, woman who was failure at life was success at suicide. And this was Pat. It's Kurt's wife. Now that's the only pair I've ever known that deliberately took themselves out of the program. The rest of us fail to do the things necessary to keep feeling right here. And we wake up to the fact that we've already had the drink. You see, when an alcoholic gets to feeling a certain way right here, he gets drunk. And it don't make a particle of the difference how many years he's been without liquor. If he allows himself to get the feeling a certain way right here, he gets drunk. Because, you see, we know a way to stop that hurt. We know a way to stop that hurt. And if we don't do it the right way, we do it the wrong way. And so, my job is to so live that I don't get the feeling that way right here, and then I won't have to drink. Formerly, you and I drank to get comfortable. Now we so live that we're comfortable and we don't have to drink, and that's That's the difference. And that's the difference that AA makes. And that's the reason I tell you that this is the only difference between me now and then, is the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because if I felt that way right now, the way that I felt 23 years ago, I would be just as drunk as I was then. And there's nothing in me that even wants to believe that that is not true. I had 43 years to run my life. During which time, I was the director and the main star of the show. 43 years. And I gave it my best shot. And at the ripe old age of 43, I was a failure in every department of life. Failure as a husband, a father, a businessman, a man, and a drunk. At 43. Now you may think it's pretty hard to be a failure as a drunk. And maybe it is, but I made it. I got to the place I couldn't buy liquor with money. And I call that a failure as a drunk. I had me a favorite liquor store. We lived in Beverly Hills. And on Pico, just off Beverly Drive, there was a liquor store called Vic's. And I put Vic's children through school. I paid off his mortgage on his store. I helped him open up in the morning. And I can tell you right now, brethren and sisters, that last 20 minutes before he got there was longer than this whole 23 years in AA. Whoa. Well, on this particular morning, I was there waiting to help him open the store. And he came. An eternity later. And we got the door unlocked. And he came in, and instead of reaching up and getting my prescription, he came in, stood behind the counter, folded his arms, and he looked me right in the eye, and he said, "Chuck, get the hell out of this store." He says, "I have contributed my last bottle to your demise. I don't want to have to watch you die. Now get out and stay out." I didn't owe him a penny, and I had money in my hand. And it's my opinion that when you can't buy liquor with money, you're a failure as a drunk. The ungrateful whelp. Incidentally, I've bought liquor from him since. He's one of my great friends now. But that was one of the things that helped to run me into Alcoholics Anonymous after 25 years. Hurried me in, you know. No, me. So there's no illusions. I have no illusions. I can't stay sober. Of myself, I cannot stay sober, and of myself, I cannot keep from drinking. So, I like this program, thank God. And I like its people, thank God. But if I hated all of you, I'd be here just the same. Just the same. Help me. This is mine home. And I couldn't come here. You know, this is a funny part of it. I couldn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous as long as I had choice. As long as I had choice, my choice was never to come here. The very idea of me coming to a bunch of drunks for help was absolutely obnoxious to me. And I had to lose everything, including the power of choice, before I could come. But those of you who are still nipping, be not discouraged. If you can't get here now, just keep nipping. And it'll be easy for you to come a little later on. To show you how tough it was for me to come, and I'm going to hurry through this because many of you have heard it. On my next to the last drunk, I made a little geographic. I drove 6,000 miles in a blackout. I drove from Beverly Hills to Louisville, Kentucky, to North Michigan, and back to the coast. And I don't remember 5% of it. Again, I had been done in, and this time by my very own son, my eldest. I had planned to bring him back into the hills where I was raised before he went into the Navy. And the time came for me to go, and of course, I left the office with money in my pocket and 2 weeks vacation coming up. So, naturally, I got me a pipe to help me get home. And I drank that pint before I got home, and therefore it was necessary for me to get another one. Because I still had fat. And I finally got packed and came walking out of the car, and Bill was in the car, and he took one look at me, and he says, "Dad, you're drunk." Oh, I says, "No, I'm not, Bill. Ha ha." I says, "This is a vacation. I've had a couple of drinks, but we're going to have fun." He says, "No, you're drunk. I'm not going." And I argued with him, and he took his suitcase and got out of the car and went to the house. So, he couldn't do that to his dear old father. So I went without him. I filled his place up with liquor and headed east. I remember two or three things. The first thing I remember, I came to, and it was very, very dark, but there was a little light. There was a train coming. And the headlight was going right over the nose of my car. And the whistle was blowing, and the bell was ringing. And I says, "Uh-oh, I'm on the railroad track." But there's nothing I could do about it. I just sat there. And the train went right by and just scraped the nose of my car. And as soon as the engine got by, of course, it was so dark you couldn't see your hand before you. And it was a rather nerve-wracking experience. And so a man can't go to sleep under those circumstances. So I reached under the seat and pulled out a fifth. And I drank till daylight. And when it got light enough to see, it was very apparent that you couldn't get where I was. I was about 500 yards off the road at the bottom of the canyon. And you couldn't even get down there, therefore you couldn't possibly get out. And there was nothing for me to do but to drink. Which I did. Well, the next thing I remember, I again came to. But this time I was in the pokey. And it was the least little pokey I was ever in my life. There was only one cell in this joint, and I had it. And there wasn't anybody else in the building. And I didn't know what state I was in, what town I was in, but I knew where I was. Ha ha! The familiar feel of that inverted waffle iron. I knew about that. Well, I had to wait again until daylight to find out where I was and what I was in for. And the first guy that came in was the state trooper who had captured me. And he thought it was quite a joke. He said that I was driving on the wrong side of Highway 66, scattering traffic like pigeons. And when he dropped in behind me, it seemed that I thought it was a great joke, and I took off, really. And he had a little difficulty, but he caught me. I had a little trouble getting out of there. I finally bought my way out and went on home. I remember my dad and mother, they were pretty old. And they were trying to talk with me, and they couldn't. And I can remember them crying. I broke their hearts, but I didn't stop there. I visited the whole family, they tell me. And I broke them all, broke all their hearts. And I finally got back to the coast. With the same air in my tires, I presume, that I had when I left. And you can't even do that sober, you know. Well, when I got home, I went to bed to finish my drunk, which was my wont. In my last 10 years, I was a periodic. And I ended all of my drunks in bed, drinking clock around. And I never quit as long as I could roll out to get another supply. But when I couldn't even move, when Mrs. C would have to lift my head to give me a little liquid, I'd have to quit. For some reason or other, they wouldn't bring me any. They were not very understanding. And this time came, and I had to knock it off. And maybe it's 24, 36 hours after my last drink, I'm able to go to the kitchen to get a glass of buttermilk. Mrs. C and Dick were sitting in the living room, and they heard me let out a beller, and they heard me hit the floor. And they came running out there expecting to find me in an alcoholic convulsion, which was my wont. But I wasn't in a convulsion. I wasn't doing anything. I was just lying there as quiet and nice as you please. They tell me I was a very peculiar color. I looked a great deal like a cadaver. And they couldn't wake me up. Well, now this tickles me anymore because I have a peculiar sense of humor. I laugh when everybody else cries and cry when everybody else is laughing. So, I keep thinking, you know, about those times when I came off a drunk and 90% of the town was looking for me. 90% of them just to tell me they never wanted to see me again. Now, this kills me. Why do they have to ferret us out? Go to any length to run us down just to tell us they never want to see us again. Well, I'm quite sure that my wife and kids have been praying for me to die for at least 5 years. And they come out in the kitchen and find me dead. And they get all exercise. And they get the oxygen squad down from the Beverly Hills Receiving Hospital to wake me up. And eventually they did. And there's a young doctor with them. And I remember talking with him a little after I'd come around. And he told me, to all intents and purposes, I had been dead. He told me that nobody would ever be able to bring me back again under those circumstances. And he told me that if he was me, he wouldn't do that anymore. It seems like they were a Guinness. Well, maybe it's 24 or 36 hours later than this when I get well enough to get the old dirty bathrobe on and start walking. Up and down the living room floor. Sweating, freezing, shaking, dying, and walking. When the late President Kennedy started talking about that 50-mile hike, you know, as I laughed out loud, I did that before breakfast. Time after time after time. In the living room yet. So I'm walking. We had a corner fireplace. And Mrs. C was standing over by the fireplace. And I was walking away from her. And she said to me, "Chuck, don't you think you might get a little help if you'd read the book Alcoholics Anonymous?" And I turned on her like a liar. I says, "You, my very own wife, suggesting that I read a book written by a bunch of drunks. I who have read all the good books with the good authors. And you want, why, I says, you wound me deeply." I'd just been dead 48 hours before. And she wounds me deeply. And I polished her off by saying, "And besides, I can write a better book than that myself." So I couldn't come. I couldn't come here until I'd lost everything, including the power of choice. But that came the next time out. The very next time out. It all went for the board. Now I'm sure that there are only two classes of alcoholics who can fulfill the conditions for sobriety. There's just two classes of them. One are those like myself who have drunk the last dregs out of the bottom of the cup. In crisis, it's not too tough. It is amazing how simple and easy it is to surrender when you ain't got nothing to give up. It's a thing. And the other class are those who come to see the nature of our problem. Now, either we have to come to see that there's nothing ahead of us but permanent insanity or an alcoholic death, or we have to drink the last dregs out of the bottom of the cup. Otherwise, we will not do the things necessary to bring about sobriety and to maintain it. We won't do it. We're a peculiar breed of cats. In the first place, we can't hear until we can hear, and we can't see till we can see. I mean, it's impossible. We simply cannot. And how long it takes, it takes. And what it takes, it takes. I remember a number of years ago, I was in Little Rock, Arkansas. And our then chairman of the board of trustees, a man whom most of us right here love like a brother, He is a non-alcoholic, so I can use his name, Bernie Smith. Bernie has served the fellowship for over 25 years, over a quarter of a century. And the first time I was back to New York as delegate, some 15, 16 years ago, Bernie got up out of a sick bed in Scotland and came to the conference in New York and went back to the hospital after spending 3 days with him. Now, if it had been Bill, we would have expected him to swim the Atlantic, you know. But for a non-alcoholic, that was really, really something. He loves his fellowship. And Bernie and I were having dinner. And he says, Chuck, if a board of experts had examined you in your 20s and had told you that if you continued to drink, these things would happen to you, and had have enumerated the things that eventually did happen to you, would you have quit drinking? And I said, why no, Bernie? And his chin dropped, and he says, I mean a board of unquestioned experts. And I said, by whose authority, Bernie? Oh, Lord. This is one of our great proclivities. This is the way we got around all authority, you know. By whose authority? I got to tell this one, and then I'll hurry on. I went by the 12-step house, first one we ever had in Los Angeles. Many years ago, and it was after midnight, I'd been out yakking someplace, and I went in just to see what the action was, and there wasn't anybody in front of the house, so I went to the coffee room. And just as I pushed the door open, there were three or four guys in there with a new one. And he wasn't very far away from the bottle. And just as the door came open, he came up out of his chair. And he said, who wrote the Bible? And I pushed the door open. I said, stand back, boys. This one's mine. Oh, Lord. That's the way we got around all authority, you know. Who wrote it? By whose authority? You see, I always knew that liquor could get what? That was a cinch, you know. But me, I was different. I was different. I was too smart. It couldn't get me. And so it was that I couldn't hear and I couldn't see. Until I was prepared to hear and to see. And of course that time came. Up until my last drunk, it was never my fault that I drank. I had been drinking for 25 years. And I had a perfectly legitimate reason for every drunk I was ever on, up until my last one. It was never my fault. It was your fault. Ha ha! If you stupid, mean people had have lived like I knew you should and like I told you how, I wouldn't have had to drink. But you wouldn't do it, so I got drunk at you. And I got drunk at a lot of you. My mother-in-law was a great reason for my drinking. You know, she only had one kid. And I was married to her. And she was living with us. Had a grandson, Chief, watching me crucify her only daughter. And she didn't like me very good. And I didn't like her that good. You see, if she hadn't have been there, I wouldn't have had to crucify her daughter. So she lasted 5 years after all the rest of the excuses had gone to the board. that before I get lost, she lived with us 5 years after I sobered up. And that she had have come in the last year of her life and had have found me slapping that daughter of hers all over the living room, she would have said, "Why, Elza, what have you done?" By this time, I could do no wrong in her eyes. The time has to come with you and with me when we can and do say to ourselves, if there be fault, it is mine. If there be fault, it is mine. That last excuse has got to go over the boards. If you and I have one excuse left that is still acceptable to us, we have another drunk left. And it's just that simple. Who in the world is going to do the things this program suggests when they can still pin this on their mother-in-law? We just aren't going to do it. It wasn't his country. I feel old Al's story about the mother-in-law. I will anyway. I haven't heard it for quite a while myself, and I want to hear it again. One of your local boys from Dallas tells this story. He says these two drunks met on the street, and one of them says to the other, "How's things?" "Oh," he says, "not good." "Well," he says, "that's bad." He says, "not so bad, I got married." "Well," he says, "that's good." He says, "not so good, I got my mother-in-law too." "Well," he says, "that's bad." He says, "not so bad, she's got money." "Well," he says, "that's good." He says, "not so good, she wants to boss everything." "Well," he says, "that's bad." He says, "not so bad, she bought us a house." "Well," he says, "that's good." He says, "not so good, the house burned down." "Well," he says, "that sure is bad." He says, "not bad, brother." He says, "she burned too." And so that last excuse has got to burn up. It has got to go. Because you see, the very first condition for sobriety is to accept ourselves exactly as we are, where we are right now. That's the first condition. To accept ourselves exactly as we are, where we are right now. Our book puts it like this. It says, we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. I like to think of it sort of like this. Supposing that I wanted to go to Dallas tonight by car, and I would call up the automobile club, and I would say to them, I want to drive over to Dallas. How do I get there? And they would say to me, where are you? And I would say, I don't know. They'd say, well, you better find out where you are and then call us back. We can't tell you where to go if we don't know where you are. And that's exactly the position you and I are in. Until we accept ourselves exactly as we are, where we are, there is no chance for help. Now, it's for this reason that we tell a little bit about the nature of our problem. Why can't I successfully drink whiskey? Now, this is the thing that used to drive me absolutely nuts. It just drove me crazy, because here I am, a big guy. Good looking. Smart as a whip. Almost a genius. I have come to see very plainly in recent years that if I'd have been 2% smarter, I'd have died drunk. There wouldn't have been any hope. And people who were obviously my inferiors were always saying to me, Chuck, you can't drink. You got to quit. It drove me nuts. I'd look at the pipsqueak, and I'd say to myself, why in the hell can I drink? He does, and he ain't got it. And my answer to me was, you can, and you got to prove it. And I'm still trying to prove it 10 years after I've lost. And nobody ever told me why I couldn't drink like other people. Nobody. I went to doctors, and I loved doctors. I went to men of the cloth, and I loved them. I went to people that knew more psychiatry than there is. And I'm not that fond of them. But I haven't got anything against them either. And every one of them talked to me about willpower, backbone, stand up, being a man. Every one of them. And I was sure that was not my problem. I was born working. And I was quite an athlete in my day. And I hadn't had 1 hour's trouble with my backbone. It had always been sufficient. And I just didn't think there was anything wrong with it. Willpower I had by the yard. I could get liquor in Kansas on election day if it fell on Sunday. Depended on only on how high I was walking off the sidewalk, how long it took. If I was 3 feet off of the walk, it didn't take but just a few minutes, any place in the United States to get a crock. So my willpower was excellent, even as yours. And in the standing up and being a man department, I'd have given them cards and spades, any of them. I had spent 30 years before I came here with the second greatest obsession of my life, which was philosophy and religion. And I'd been through just about all of them in 30 years. And I knew a great deal about, mind you, I said about. It got me a name. I was known as the Drunken Deacon for 10 years. So in the standing up and being a man department, I thought I was in good shape. So they couldn't help me because they did not know the nature of my problem, and I could not help myself because I did not know the nature of my problem. And so I had to die. I had to die. And the very first night that I came here, people just like you, drunks who were not drunk, told me why I couldn't drink like other people and told me how I could live without drinking. The very first night. And it's an awful good thing to know. Now, thank God, today many priests, preachers, doctors, psychiatrists, lay people have made it their business to know the nature of our problem. And they can tell us where to go for help. But in my day, this was not true. And so I had to die. Why can't I successfully drink liquor? Because I'm an alcoholic. What is an alcoholic? An alcoholic is a person who suffers with the disease of alcoholism. The disease of alcoholism. I never heard this in my life. Until people like you told me at my first meeting. And yet I have remained to find that informed medical opinion classify alcoholism as the third worst killer in the country today, topped only by heart and cancer. As a killer. Second only to one of our social diseases, a cause for permanent insanity, and medically speaking, it's incurable. And that's what I got. I'm an alcoholic. It's a matter of life or death, and it's my life. Now, the medical definition of the disease, and we got this definition from a doctor. is that it's a disease of a twofold nature, an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. An allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. The allergy of the body meaning simply this, that my body, for some reason unknown to medical science, and still unknown to medical science, cannot successfully handle alcohol. I can't oxidize it, burn it up, and get rid of it. I take a slug of liquor, it goes into the bloodstream, into the brain, and it triggers a physical demand that makes me keep on drinking until my cycle is run. This is not true with 90% of those who drink liquor. It's only true of people like me. I am physically different than the so-called normal drinker. Now, inasmuch as nobody knows what the physical difference is, we do not spend any time on that. But a few things about the physical part of the disease I must forever keep in the upper regions of my consciousness all the time. Number one, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Regardless of some of the things you might have read, there isn't a case in medical history where anybody like me ever returned to successful drinking. That I must remember. Secondly, the physical part of the disease gets worse with the passage of time. Even during long extended periods of total abstinence. And this kills a lot of alkies. When you get a little distance between you and the jug, that old subconscious starts telling you, you're building up some good drinking time. You're building up some good drinking time. There's no such thing as an alcoholic building up any good drinking time. I am actually 23 years worse off so far as successfully drinking liquor is concerned than I was when I got here. And I know it. And I don't have to take a drink to prove it. Because I have been close to and active in this program for 23 years. And when you're close to and active in, you don't have to take that next slug. Just keep your eyes open. Your friends are forever taking it for you. And all you got to do is keep your eyes open. And if you keep your eyes open, you're going to have to watch a lot of them die, and you're not going to want to. You're not going to want to. I've had a few of my closest associates whom I have had to watch die. And believe me, I think I'd rather die in a few cases. And it's a tough lesson. But it makes it unnecessary for me ever to monkey with the idea that maybe I could handle a little light wine and beer. I know that the physical part of the disease gets worse with the passage of time. Even during long extended periods of total abstinence, and lastly, there is no cure for the body. So what are we going to do about it? Nothing. We're going to accept the fact that that's the way it is with us. And there's nothing we can do about it. And then turn to the other half of the disease. The obsession to the mind that causes us to drink. And that's what our program is all about. That's what it's all about. There's nothing in our book that tells us how to get sober. Nothing in the book. We help each other get sober. And it's a great part of our work, and it's something we would not change. I love to work with wet drunks. Now. Tell you a story. Three or 4 months ago, the young kids were having one of them was having a birthday. Young people in AA. We got a lot of them out our way, and incidentally, nearly every one of them have a dual problem. These kids, nearly every one of them have a dual problem, and we got a flock of them. And so, one of them was having a birthday, and he wanted me to come, and I went, and At the meeting, he says, a few of us want to come up to your house after the meeting. And I says, how many? Oh, he said, maybe 10, 12. I said, all right, come on up. And so when the meeting's over, Mrs. C and I go home. And pretty soon the doorbell rang. And they started coming in. And they didn't quit. It was like locusts. There were about 50 of them came piling into that house of mine. And some of you know it. I can see some of you that have sat in that living room of mine. And so they flopped all over the floor, and we had a meeting. And we had a good meeting. And about 3:30, the phone rang. And a guy said, Chuck, I'm in trouble. Can I come down? I said, where are you? He says, Anaheim. I said, have you got anybody that can drive you? Because it's 3:30, and I didn't figure a guy that was in that much trouble would better be driving at 3:30 in the morning. And he asked somebody if they'd drive him down. And they said, yes. And he came back on the phone. He says, yeah. Well, it turned out to be his wife. Now, I says it turned out to be his wife because, you see, he wasn't living there then. He just stopped by there to make a phone call. She had done kicked him out. So she brought him down, and we were talking, and the gang had cleared out. And so we were sitting there talking, and he got sick. Now he's a great big, I called him a Swede. He said he was Norwegian. I said, you know what a Norwegian is? He's a Swede with his brains kicked out. And he thought it was the reverse, you know. But he got sick, and I took him to the bathroom. Pointed him in the right direction and left. And pretty soon, I heard that familiar sound. And so I went back, you see, and I opened the door. And I just stood there and enjoyed it for about 5 minutes before I ever said a word. There was that big Swede down on his knees with his arms around the throat. For 5 years, I figured I had a patent on that position. Oh, Lord. Incidentally, he's still sober. We help each other sober up, and it's a great part of our work. But you see, it's not such a much to get sober. Physically sober. I was physically as sober as I am right now between every two drunks for 10 years. Physically as sober as I am right now between every two drunks for 10 years. But I always got drunk again and again and again and again and again and again. And something happened 23 years ago. And I haven't had to get drunk anymore. And that's what this program of ours is all about. You see, not to get us sober. We help each other get sober so that we can then work on our problem, which is alcoholism. And whilst you can get sober in from 3 to 7 days physically, if you happen to be an alcoholic and if you want to get rid of the jug forever, one day at a time, it's a job forever, one day at a time. We start now and keep going forever. And that's what this program is. It's to make it unnecessary for us to sober up anymore. And this is takes some doing. This takes some doing. Our book says it takes a little help from a power greater than ourselves. That's what the book says. The book says lack of power was our dilemma. And it was obvious if we lacked the power, we had to find one. And it was just as obvious that it had to be a power greater than we are. Now, I believe this. The book says under certain conditions, certain circumstances, it seems that there's only one defense against that first slug, the drink I mustn't take. And that's help from a power greater than ourselves. And this I believe. I believe it just as I believe I'm standing here right now. And for just as simple a reason. If I could have remained sober, I would not believe it. I could not remain sober, therefore I believe it. Because I haven't had to drink for a long time. Now, how are we going to get the help from a power greater than ourselves? We've got a formula that's absolutely foolproof. And all we have to do is fulfill the conditions of the formula. And something happens and we don't have to drink anymore. It's a fabulous thing. If we could just get this through our heads. That all we got to do is to do what the book tells us. Number one, we already had. To accept ourselves exactly as we are where we are right now. That's number one. Number two is that sobriety has to come first, ahead of everything. Top man on the totem pole. And the book puts that like this. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. Any length puts the top man on the totem pole. So sobriety has to come first. Then you're ready to take certain steps. And then it says here are the steps we took. T-double-O-K took. Here are the steps we took. And this is the great paradox of Alcoholics Anonymous. We can't read it. And it's not because we're too dumb, it's because we're too smart. Now there's only one word in there, it's got five letters. Here are the steps we took, it says. We can't read it. You see, it don't say here are the steps we heard read. Or here are the steps we learned by heart. Or here are the steps we discussed in last night's discussion meeting. All these things are good, but they're not good enough. It does not say, here are the steps we interpreted. If you want to stay drunk a little while longer, start interpreting the steps. You can nip and interpret and nip and interpret, and then you nip and don't interpret. And neither does it say, here are the steps we conned God into taking for us. We'd like to put that in there too, wouldn't we? But it don't say that. It says, here are the steps we took. And when you and I get simple enough to took them, we're home free. We're home free. Here are the steps we took. Now, why is it so necessary for us to take these steps and apply them to our very own self? Because we've got to get a little help from a power greater than ourselves. And in order to get it, we got a little work to do on us. We got some wreckage of the past to clear away. We got some windows to wash. And the first nine steps in this program do it for us. The first nine steps will surrender anybody that will take them. That's what they're there for. And we're going to look at them quick with this one thing in mind to get us out of our own way. The first one says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. A twofold admission of defeat. Powerless over alcohol, physical, unmanageable as mental. Now, it's very significant that it does not say that our lives had become unmanageable whilst drunk. Now, many of us read it that way. Maybe for years we read it that way. Unmanageable lives whilst drunk, but we're pretty cute operators when we're sober. Don't say that. Now, this is a twofold admission of defeat, and it is not alcoholic thinking. This is not alcoholic thinking. How many of you guys ran into the bar and said to the guy, I am powerless over alcohol, my life is unmanageable, give me a double? Like hell you did. You see, you got to prepare him for the time a little bit later when you forgot your pocketbook. You see, you got to get him ready for that. So you tell him not that you're powerless over alcohol, that your life is unmanageable. But you tell him about the merger you just put through. You just sold a railroad. Yeah, you got to set him up. This is not alcoholic thinking. A twofold admission of defeat in the first step. The second step, we admit we're nuts. That's going pretty fast. First one, a twofold admission of defeat. The second one, we're nuts. It's a sneaky one because it says, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Now, that's very inoffensive. But there's no sense in restoring a sane person to sanity. Did you ever think of that? So in this cute little way, we got to admit we're nutty as a fruitcake. That's only number two. The squeeze plays on. And number three, we got to give up the keys. Now, this is a dandy. I can just see you coming out of the bar about 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning with your wife or somebody else's wife. And you get to the parking lot, you know, and she says very nicely, honey, give me the keys. I'll drive. And you say, what car? This car is mine. Now, if you're going with me, get in. I'm driving. And you fight it all over the parking lot for 2 hours, but you never give up the keys. And here number three says, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. We got to give up the keys. Number three. Just number three. The squeeze plays on. And number four is worse than all three of them. Number four says we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Now this is a switch. Here am I, for instance, who has taken the inventory of everybody I ever knew, and many people that were just walking by. And I gotta take mine. Now, if you think that's an ego builder, get a thick pad and a long pencil and start writing. We made a searching and fearless moral inventory of me. And the squeeze plays on. And number five is a king-size ego buster. It's the worst. There isn't anything worse than this one. It says, we admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Now I can hide out here behind the building and admit to me and God. And nobody knows but me and God. It's still a secret. But to lay this dirty linen out before another human being. Why is it there to surrender us at depth?
If you got any ego left after that one, you ain't done it. Start over. Now, that's only five, and the next two show you what's already happened. After we've written this stuff down and looked it over and shared it, we become willing to give it away. And we give it away. We were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. And I'd like to take just a second on this because I find it so damaging amongst my people to keep pulling these things out and working them over again and again and again and again and again. It can kill you. Thank God. It isn't necessary for us to beat these defects of character one at a time. If I'd have had this to do, I'd have died drunk. It can't be done. It's too much. It's too tough. But the book don't say that. It says we look them over, share them, become willing to give them away and give them away. And you know how silly I am? You know how I know whether I've given them away or not? If I haven't got them. Now, isn't that peculiar? If I haven't got them, I've given them away. If I've still got them, I didn't. It's that simple. And what I can give away, He can take. And does. And if there's anything left, the next two steps, get it. 8 and 9 are two of the most beautiful steps in the program. You get through with these, you feel like an inside shower. You feel clean, clear through. Don't hesitate if you haven't taken steps 8 and 9. Do it. We made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And we made direct amends to such people wherever possible. Except when to do so would injure them or others. And I got to tell a little story on this, too. But I'm almost done. Here you guys that want to get to dancing. It won't be too long now. And I'll tell you what I'll let you do. You dance for me, will you? I had to be sober 5 years to find out I couldn't dance. I would have given Fred Astaire lessons. Back when I was operating. But I can't dance. Anyway, I got a call on a Friday night about 6, 7 years ago from a man in Whittier. And he says, Chuck, I'm sitting here with a 6-gun in my lap. And I'm going to blow my brains out. But he says, Jim told me not to pull the trigger until I talk to you. And he says, now what have you got to say? And I says, well, Dad, you called me on a bad night. I says, I'm talking tonight, Saturday night, and Sunday night. But Monday night's open. Now, if you want to see me, come down Monday night, and if you don't, go ahead and blow your brains out. And Monday night at 7:30, the doorbell rang. And he came in. And it was 2:30 in the morning when we were right where we are right now. We made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Now this chap, along with other things, was a gambler. An obsessive gambler. And he lost a lot of money that he did not have. And I was telling him, and a lot of this dough was lost to professional gamblers, too. And I was telling him, I said, now, here's what you got to do. If you want to get out of this mess you're in, you've got to do it. You got to go to these people and tell them that you're not the big shot that you would have had them believe. That you're an alcoholic. And that you've found a way to live one day at a time without drinking. And it might let you live the rest of your life without taking another drink. Tell them that you recognize the debt. And that you'll pay it just as fast as you can, but you ain't got no money. Why, he says, Chuck, they'll kill me. And I said, so what? You won't have suicide on your mind. And the guy started laughing. And he's still laughing. And he's walking the streets a free man and he don't owe nobody nothing. Don't delay on these steps. We made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. We made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. You see, I gave this thing everything I had. I gave it my wife, our children, our home, my job, my health, my sanity, and my money. And I lost. And I lost. So who am I to question these steps? When you people told me, here are the steps we took. These are the things we did. We're sober. I said to me, these are the things you're going to do and see what happens. And that's what I've been doing now for 23 years. Now, that's 9 steps and we're surrendered if we've taken them. And we stay level with number 10. We continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. I'd like to talk a little about that, too, but I won't. Because I want to talk just a little about 11 and 12. If it weren't for step 11, I would not be here. If it were not for step 11, I would not be. Because, you see, I can't run my life. Had 43 years to do it. And I can't do it. And I know it. But I can pray for knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry it out. And I do it and I get it. I live by step 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious awareness of the living presence of the Almighty. Praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry it out. And I do it very simply and very sensibly, as far as I'm concerned, just like a kid. When I drive out through Laguna Canyon, going to my office in the morning, I'm talking a little bit to somebody that you wouldn't see if you were driving behind me. Sometimes I might be talking, sometimes I might be laughing, sometimes I might be crying. Sometimes you might think I was nuts. But I'm very simple with this thing. I say, look, Father, I'm reporting for duty. Now I'm going to move it around. I'm going to do the best I can with what I got today. And all I want out of you is a little guidance and direction, the power to carry it out. Sure, thank you. And I go about my business. And I get it. I expect guidance and direction in everything I do. And I get it. How do I know? I never had it so good. So I live by step 11. And step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. Now there's an implication here too. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of the first 11 steps. I don't think it's very sensible for you and I to think we can have a spiritual awakening as the result of 11 steps that we ain't took. I don't think that works. But this says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And I'm one who believes you can't take them without it. Many of us don't recognize it for some time. But it's there just the same. And we finally discover that it has happened. We tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. Now again, carrying this message to alcoholics is a thing that most of us love. Just love. And in the doing, we learn something that's invaluable, that there's no words to express. And that is that St. Francis knew what he was talking about when he says, for it is in giving that we receive. Just in the attempt to give this thing away, we learn that this has never been a getting life. Never. It has forever been a giving life, and the more we pour out without a price tag on it, the more we have. And again, how do I know? All I got to do is look at my own books. That's the way it is. And practice these principles in all of our affairs. And when we get simple enough to practice these principles in all of our affairs, we're put back together again. We are made whole. And we see that nothing is more or less important and nothing is more or less spiritual than another. Because when you're practicing the same principles in everything that you do, it's all one. It's nothing in the world but being. Being. And that's what this program is all about. To put us back together so that we might live as we are. Which is going about our Father's business as our Father's children should. That's all it is. It's beautiful. It is terrific. And it gets better with the passing of the days. Don't let anybody tell you that the pink cloud is it's got to turn gray. Or that the honeymoon has got to be over. I find nothing in my book that says that. And I find nothing in 23 years' experience. Because my life has continued to get better from the very second that I said to myself, at the end, at what turned out to be the end, of 4 weeks of lying dead drunk with no consciousness of any one of the days that passed. When I said to myself, if I ever live to get out of this bed, I'll find AA. From that second until now, my life has gotten better. And the discoveries have come one after another for 23 years. And they're still coming. Now I'm going to tell one more little story and sit down. I don't want to. I came a long ways. Oh, Lord. I want to tell you a story about carrying the message. If I can tell it without breaking down, I hope I can. But a number of years back, a cousin of mine, my favorite cousin, said that the son of their next door neighbors was killing himself with a bottle and wanted to know if I'd call on him. Now, I've always been one who believes in cold turkey calls. I hear many of our people say, well, did the alcoholic call? I get impatient. Suppose Bill had waited for Dr. Bob to call. You and I'd have been dead long ago. So I've always believed in cold turkey calls. You get thrown out of lots of places. But that's just sort of natural. We keep our hand in that way. So I said, yes, I will gladly call on him, and I did. This chap was a youngster, about 30 years old. And he had been promoted to major on the battlefields of Germany in the Second World War. And I got out there, and he was in a dressing gown, and he was sitting on one side of a low table. And I came in and sat down across the table from him, told him who I was and why I was there. And he said, proceed. And I did. And I talked with him maybe 20, 25 minutes. And he got up and he stuck out his hand and he says, Chuck, you've done me a lot of good. I sure thank you for coming. And I says, you'd certainly like to get rid of me, wouldn't you? But I ain't ready. I says, I don't want to go yet. Now, you need a drink pretty badly. Why don't you get it? And he says, I will if you'll go with me. And I says, I'll go with you. And he got up and he came out from behind that table and came in through the room and head back into his bedroom. And me right with him. And he walked over to the side of his bed and he got down on the floor and he started feeling under that bed. And I started dying because I was right down there feeling just with him, you know. And pretty soon he hit one and I saw the expression on his face and he fished it out. And when he got it out, it was empty. And again, his face. And oh, my God, I was dying right with him. And then he stood up, and he stood there in the room, and you could just see the wheels go. Because he knew he had a full one. And he didn't know where it was, you know. Now, this is the greatest frustration there is. There's nothing like it when you know you got it. And you know you put it someplace and you can't find it. This is a killer. And so then he got another idea. And he walked over to his clothes closet. And he started patting those coats. And that did it for me. Ah, it just killed me. How many times have I gone through that closet patting those coats? And pretty soon he hit another one. And he pulled it out. And it was brand full. The seal wasn't even broken. And the happy expression on his face. And he turned to me. And he says, you see, Chuck, I'm blind. I didn't know he was blind. And here a blind man had showed me better than anybody that I'd ever seen in my lifetime. He had turned me inside out. Now I wish I could tell you that he got well. But I can't. I never got to see him once when he wasn't either full of pills or full of booze. And I talked to him, and I'd say to him, why don't you let me come? Let me come at midnight, or at 4 o'clock in the morning, or any time. When you're not full of this flit. Because I learned to love the guy. I loved him like a brother. And he was just like me, because he'd say to me, the Stuart never surrenders. The Stuart never surrenders. And you could see him on that battlefield, you know. He never surrendered there. He was made a major right there on the battlefield. And of course, I never got to tell him when he could understand what it means to get out of your own way
and let go and let God. And I had to watch him die. But not until he'd shown me a lesson that I shall never forget. Blind though he was, he made me see how very fortunate I am and how very fortunate you are. You see, I am alive because a drunk had time. I'm alive because a drunk had time. And of course, I have no illusions about this thing. God works through people. God works through people and through the drunk who took me on his lap and rocked me to sleep. I have been able to live, lo, these 8,400 days. And I have sort of a sneaking suspicion that as long as I have time, I might be here with you. God bless you. Thank you very much.